I got it.
There's a million of us at it, and it's hard to break the habit, but it doesn't mean much to me.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to our second podcast in our hopefully long series of Two Lifetimes in Music. I'm here again with Nigel Crouch, and today
hold on. Before you go any further, disclaimer from me, one disclaimer. On the first podcast, I sang. Now, I am not a singer of any description, except for a description that we can't broadcast. But if ever I sing anything, it's just to show an example of something. I am not a singer. Don't write to me. And the other thing I didn't get quite right was when I was talking about music college, and I said, oh, you're just going for an hour. That's a bit... it's not quite right. Anybody's
been to
music college.
Are you rewriting our previous podcast?
Would. Anyone who's been to music college would be shouting at the thing because you do only have an hour usually on your subject, but you have a second study which you'll go in and have. And if you want to, you can attend history classes and piano accompaniment. There are other things. If you're in the orchestra, you go in. So it's not just 1 hour, is 1 hour on your principal subject. That's done. I'm okay. I've wriggled out of everything.
We've just had amazing, 700, over 800 replies now about you not being a singer. Quite agreed from Henry in Russia. No need to tell us from Harriet in Brazil.
Oh dear, it's all going very well.
We started the podcast with the music from Cutting Crew from the rare Compos Mentis album, and the song was called Another One of My Big Ideas, which I thought lyrically fitted today because we're going to be talking about songwriting, you know, where it starts, where it comes from. There's been hundreds of thousands of interviews and discussions about, you know, maybe the inspiration, and you know, I was struck by this lyric or whatever. So we're not going to talk too much about that. It'd be much more about the real, where it came from literally, you know, where you put your hands down on the keyboard, or an idea or a story or something.
Yeah, there are some interesting things that have been said about it. I mean, there's he's among my favourite composers, British, called Richard Rodney Bennett, who died some years back.
Yeah.
Wrote some brilliant music, lots of TV and film music, and also was a jazz pianist. I mean, I saw him down at Pizza Express in London, accompanying Claire Martin, the jazz singer, I think. And he said, he moved to New York, and he said, when he gets up in the morning, he said, you can't sit around and wait for inspiration. He said, he goes to his desk, and it might take an hour or an hour and a half or 2 hours. You have to get yourself to a place where you can be inspired, because your head normally is filled with either mowing the lawn, or the dishwasher man's coming, or the, you know, the plumber's on his way. You've got to get yourself to a place where things can start to happen.
Yeah.
And I think you can't just walk around expecting it just to happen in the middle of the day. And of course, the great Andre Previn also said that when you, it's better to always write something every day, even if you're going to put it in the bin, than just to sort of think, well, I don't know what to do. I haven't got any ideas.
Yes.
Write something, screw it up, bin it. Yeah, not bad advice.
No, I think that's pretty fair just of me. I mean, I very rarely you walk along and you whistle a tune and scurry home and it's your next song. It's mostly prep and hard work. Although I do find that blank page scenario pretty scary. I mean, we'll talk about Sandrina Sedona later in our chat, but beautiful Italian friend of ours. And she has courses, you know, where she has 20 people come down to the Dordogne and she teaches them how to write and how to sing or teaches them how to find a way to. Mm. And one of those is the blank page, you know.
Yeah.
And she's always saying, Nick, so do the blank page this morning and just tell me what you've written. No, I'm not very good at that. I have to kind of get sounds up and get the voice sounding good and all that. Mine's much more of a aesthetically pleasing moment that then when my voice, love it or hate it, and what my hands do at the same time, that synchronicity, that's when I ping off.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
And there is, I thought they always say there are two basic elements to writing. You've got your inspirational idea and you've got the craft.
Yes.
Now we all have to sometimes go, well, wait a minute, at this point I'm not sure how to get from here to here. I need a bridge to get from the verse to the chorus, or it might be you've got to the end of a passage in a classical piece and you've got to change key to get to this idea that for some reason. So the craft has to come in. You have to know your stuff. You have to know a few chords to get to where you want to go or whatever it might be. The craft is important.
Very good. And that's as you get more accomplished, you know, that sometimes it gets in the way. Sometimes you can, you know, go around that up the Khyber Pass and back and you didn't need to. Kevin was much more a musical than me. So he I'd write the basics and he would take it from there. Mm. And then another one of my big ideas, you know, in that whole song, I think there's four key changes of which he always used to say, changing key is good, but getting back to where you came from ain't so easy.
It's always a roadmap music. I used to do it when I was teaching. I said, look, you've got to get from here to here.
Yeah.
And there are different ways. That's why some people, if you had a jazz pianist, he would take that passage of music and he would take this particular roadmap that involves all these fancy chords, whereas someone else with a different ear would take it a different roadmap that gets you there more directly.
Yes.
As long as you arrive and it works, that's the
point. It is, and that's the craft bit, I suppose. But as I was kind of getting at, you know, one of the Jam songs from their first album's got three chords and tons of attitude, and it's as good as any Devious, if you know what I mean. Speaking of which, crunch, I think that for me, you know, there are big Polaroids in your life that you'll never forget, whether it be, you know, family or love or in this case, talking about music and wanting to be a musician. I can only guess about 12 or 13 years old, and there was this omnibus program, so you can work that out. It would have been early 70s, something like that. Maybe later. Early 70s.
Probably not later, I don't think.
Anyway, that's an old BBC sort of like news magazine programme.
Yeah, sort of arty stuff.
Arty stuff, Switch off now. And Ken Russell, who went on then to become a much more famous and nutty film director, he was a young man working with the BBC and he did three pieces and one of them was on Delius. And it's just an astonishing piece. I've just bought the DVD. It cost me like 50 quid or something. It's that rare. And it tells of Delius, the composer, and this crotchety old man living in France by now, riddled with syphilis.
Yeah.
And he, you know, this story. He was could barely walk or write, couldn't he? And he brought down his... What would you call the man that writes for you?
I think they call him an amanuensis. I mean, that's not a word I've ever used before. It's not a word that's come out of my mouth.
Can you say it again?
I think it's amanuensis.
Amanuensis.
But he was the man who was brought in to put down on paper what Delius was mouthing and trying to sing.
He was saying, like, you know, bassoons, bar 53 bassoons. No, on the second beat. You know,
then he would go, da, 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 and you couldn't even understand what the notes were.
And George, you know, George, what was his name, George?
Oh, George Formby. Oh, yeah, of course he was there all the time with Delius, well known for it. In fact...
When I'm scribing music, or when I'm scribing music.
Delius insisted on having George Formby. And the only reason George Formby stayed, it is believed, is because Delius kept saying, in my next work, there's going to be a ukulele solo. So he kept hanging on for it, and it never happened.
That ukulele concerto.
George, it was, of course, George. Eric Fembe.
Oh, thank you. Fembe Formby. Whoops.
Yeah.
A senior moment there, folks.
No, it was wonderful. It's very haunting, wasn't it? Because I remember it as vividly as you do. It really made a big impression.
Black and white. And So, and I was a lad playing bad flamenco guitar at that point, but it was an important point in my life, and I'm sure that many people have, whether they become potters or car repairers, you know, it's certain things that set you up, you know.
Yeah, and of course he would have to start from a blank page, and George Formby would notate what he was, you know, that very those very first notes on that blank page of manuscript paper. Yeah. So the blank page is a big thing for all creative people, whether you're an author, a rock star, a composer, it doesn't matter. You have to start somewhere. Well, they say, don't they, Rod Stewart and his gang, they used to lock them in a room with a crate of whiskey and they wouldn't come out until the album had been written.
Is that right?
That's what he said, apparently, yeah. But they did come out and they did have some great songs. But you've got to find a mechanism that works for you and get the work done.
So. Yeah, well, whiskey certainly helped with me a few times. I do remember going back to that, you know, write, what was it, Previn said, you know, write a lot rather than write nothing. And I would often end up, you know, 2 a.m. with that whiskey, writing, thinking I was, this is the next big thing, you know. Wake up the next morning, it's like, what on earth are you thinking?
Yeah. So it was a good night.
It was a good night.
Well, I think at this point we should give Ruth Barrett a call, because she is a very well-established TV and film composer. She's an ex-student of mine, although she denies it vehemently. I assure everyone it's true. But it'd be great to see what she thinks about life as a TV film composer, what it's really like behind all of that, behind all the glamour that she's now beginning to accumulate around her. So I think we should give her a call and get her take on
giving birth. Yes, exactly. So we managed to set that up, and here I am joining them and eavesdropping the chat between us and Ruth Barrett.
And you then took part in a concert I gave where we did two pianos and we did a couple of quite big improvisations, one on The Rite of Spring.
Yeah.
And then, am I right in thinking, I'm not good at this, is after that is when you went off to Cambridge, yeah?
After that I went to Cambridge, yeah.
Yeah, so you went off to study music at Cambridge, really, ever since, working in the composing for TV and film. And look, it's fair to say you are now one of the major players in that field. You're known for doing music for the Durrells, for the Bodyguard, Collateral, Victoria, loads more. But also I'd like to know about a very exciting project that cropped up recently. Can you remember what it was?
I don't know what's going on. Life's a blur at the moment.
I bet it is.
Yeah, I'm working on all this American stuff now. Like, I'm working on Law and Order, which is like a network TV show in the States, which is really kind of cool, with Chris Maloney. Mm-hmm. And then another American show called Terminal List with Chris Pratt in it. So I'm just doing music for these beefy guys at the moment. The perks of the job, you might say.
Yes,
you do have to spend rather a long time staring at them and making tunes.
Today we're doing this by FaceTime, so you're looking at me and Nick. It must be pretty similar.
Yeah, I'm struggling to come up with a tune to go with that. I'm enjoying you, I have to say.
Good. Yeah.
You know, but starting with you, when I kind of started off as classical piano, but when I met you at age 15, and we started improvising and working on different ideas, that kind of did blow my mind and really get my composition going. I really blame you for my career choice, because we used to have such fun listening to records and messing around with ideas on two pianos, and sometimes we just chat about, I don't know, we just come up with a word or some starting point, and we just make a piece of music in that. Because your thing was moment composition. I even did my dissertation on it.
Did you?
at college, I had to make it a bit more academic.
Sophisticated,
but it was basically about that, trying to explore that idea of like, how do you write music and what happens in that moment, how does the creative process work?
Yeah.
And I kind of still write like that in a way, like how we used to just kind of do something in that instant that felt emotional and just responding to something is how I start coming up with ideas for things. It just, I don't know quite how it happens, but you just connect with something on the screen or a scene or a bit of muscle or whatever.
That is interesting, because actually that ties in very nicely, because this podcast is called Giving Birth, and it's about, we talk about the fact that how Nick, what happens when Nick comes up with an idea for a song, or I come up with an idea for a piece of music. We talk about that initial getting pregnant and then giving birth to an idea.
You're experiencing those matters, aren't you?
I did say during the podcast that women will be shouting at the speaker saying, what do I know about giving birth?
I have given birth twice. I certainly didn't come up with any bloody symphonies whilst I was in the act.
All right, listen, you win. All right, you win. But very quickly.
I know what you mean.
Very quickly. That's all true about what we did. But if I think back, all I think of, all I can see us doing was eating.
We did a lot of eating, and but you introduced me to some really amazing music at that time.
Okay.
And I don't think I knew of Stravinsky before, and Richard Strauss and Bartok and all those kind of that era of composition. And we would eat and drink beer, but listen to the music. And I was in such a kind of impressionable age. I was like 16, 17.
Mm.
And that really, it really did something. You know, I really felt like that's when I started to really write music and want to write music and feel inspired by stuff. And I think that's because I was wondering, why the hell did I end up doing this? Because, you know, I was fairly academic at school. So we could have trained to, I don't know, I wanted to be a brain surgeon or something like that. I chose to do this weird game. But I think that period of time is when I really, you know, started to feel it.
Well,
you are quite, you know, important part of this process.
Well, listen, you've certainly turned it into something very productive. So look, all the credit to you. But let's tell us about what's it been like. Has it been different working with the musicians and the people involved in LA to working here in Britain?
Well, people in the US, everything's bigger and I don't know, there's two different people. So on Law and Order, there's a lot of positive energy, and it was a really, really fast turnaround. Yeah. So you had to produce music really scarily quickly. I think the last show, the last series, we had 2 days to make the final episode, which is quite, you know, there's gangsters and guns and shootouts and chases and all sorts. But they were filming right to the last second, so it was... And it was going on air, so there was literally...
Yeah, that's astonishing. And is there like a person on set who'll go, this is fantastic, Ruth, but can it be a little edgier or a bit darker? And then you've got to go, oh, shit, and run back to the studio and all that.
Oh, yeah. Basically, we didn't leave the studio, we didn't sleep. It was like proper sweat, you know, going on, like, oh, in a few hours, this is going to be on air across America.
Yeah.
And we can't let them down. You know, and also we wanted to make it really epic.
But presumably you had top class musicians involved.
Yeah, I've got an amazing gang of musicians. So they were, but what we've learned to do across lockdown is everybody's learned how to record themselves at home and send us the files.
That's an interesting process, isn't it? Because all our lives we've been very one face to face. You know, being able to catch the eye of somebody or make a joke or, you know, now a bit faster, you know, instant interaction. The last album we did was with the Prague Philharmonic, and, you know, they were in Prague. I was in Sussex, my guitarist was in Manchester, the engineer was in Slovenia, and the drummer was in bloody Russia. And, you know, the people, you know, sending files in, but then, of course, it's not, no, the hi-hat, oh, God, you've got to try and get across the lilt of the hi-hat to a Russian called Sergei. It was tricky when we got there, but yeah. I didn't enjoy it as much, obviously, you know.
Yeah,
it is the communication, isn't it? But when you've got a gang that you work with a lot, they kind of know.
Totally get that, yeah.
What you're on about.
Yeah.
And are you working on Law and Order at the moment?
Law and Order and Terminal List.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Terminal List.
What is that?
Chris Pratt is a Navy SEAL.
Okay.
That's all I can say. Not like a SEAL, like,
I think we got that as well, Ruth.
Okay.
But thanks for clarification. Always good.
Okay, good.
The lovely thing is that you're based, we're all in three different fields because I'm not really in any field, but I'm sort of sitting down in Sussex writing
in the field
classical music. You're in the world of TV film, and Nick, of course, is in the sort of pop rock business. So, but the lovely thing is there are overlaps. Like the last album that Nick did was with the Prague Philharmonic. And so we get these overlaps where Nick has had to deal with the arranger or, you know, the orchestrator and musicians in, you know, with violins and things. So it's nice that we've all got these overlaps within our different worlds. You have all these deadlines and you stay up really late. I spend 3 weeks walking around the garden thinking about one phrase about should I use the cor anglais or the bass clarinet? I was like, you know, so it's very,
yeah.
It's very different. And I know. I want to know, look, let's get really honest. What is it like? If you had your time again, would this be the career you wanted? Is it stressful and is it a mix of being really exciting and just really horrible? What's it like being Ruth Barrett, the musician?
Yeah, you know, I think so. I think I love the pressure in a way. I think that kind of motivates me. But there's the fear bit. It's like walking the hot coals before you get to that nice bit of adrenaline that kind of propels you forward. Is you got to get through that bit of fear, which it happens on every single job. And that questioning of yourself is like, maybe I'm not the right person for this, or can I do this?
Yeah.
Always goes through, and then there's that horrible anxiety phase. And then suddenly an idea comes, and you don't know where it's come from, but it comes, and then you kind of connect, and then that bit is magical. And that's what that's the good bit of the job, and that's what I feel like.
When you know, obviously you've written all your life, or you know, all your adult life, and the beauty of that, but with Law and Order and with, you know, the other things you do, that's to order, you know, so when I always found that if we were making an album and somebody said, right, now Nick, you've just got three more to write, you know, can you do one for this and one for that, I didn't enjoy that as much as the free flow. So throwing that back to you, obviously this is a fantastic accolade you have now, an opportunity, and all the chaos and everything you've described. Would you like one day where you can just sit down on your own and go, I'm going to write a little piano sonata or something?
I've been trying to do that the age 18.
Yeah.
Actually, that was the last time we did it.
Really?
And Nigel keeps telling me, you know, just do that in your spare time, you know, just build up some stuff that you just want to do. And it's like, I never seem to find that time.
Spare time, yeah.
Yeah, and also I think maybe I'm scared of it as well, because it's like, well, what would I do if it's just me? It gives you something to go on, doesn't it? It gives you kind of a starting point.
Yeah.
Opposed to the blank page, which I think is pretty
daunting.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is daunting.
Well, of course, you and Nick share that in common. You've both got greyhounds.
Oh, yes!
Yeah. He's also got a three-legged lurcher somewhere around here.
Oh, wow, well, we have to take them for a walk sometime.
That's a promise.
Can we come down and do that? That would be lovely. Really fun.
Yeah. Hey, Ruth, I feel like we're doing an interview
I feel like we're doing an interview and also buying your house.
Look at it. Doesn't it look fantastic, though? Look.
Fantastic.
She's got a mobile cocktail trolley as well.
Here is the lounge and over to the
cocktail trolley.
But there's two strands to that, and I don't know you at all, and I'm, you know, falling in love with you by the minute. But really, isn't it also about you're hitting the bar as well? Of course you've got to give the client what they want. But, you know, there's a bar that I have to hit or I just won't even, it won't be shared with the dog, you know?
Yeah, I think if you don't feel that inside, then it's like, what have you got?
Yeah.
You have to feel like a goosebump, like a shiver or like, oh, that's, it's lifted off. Like watching that piece of film with the music, it feels like it's elevated.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't believe that in your heart, then it's shit.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Well, I think the difference is, I think we all know the bar that Ruth hits.
Yeah.
It's slightly different.
Yeah, I hit the bar before I hit the bar.
Well, listen, Ruthie, come down and see us soon and meet Nick properly and everything. It'd be great to see you again soon.
Lovely talking to you, darling.
Great. You take care, Ruth.
Pleasure.
Thanks for that.
Bye.
See ya. Bye-bye. Bye. Take care.